The Hummingbirds have influenced both gospel and secular music in many ways. They were the first gospel group to tour and to play places like nightclubs. Their vocal harmonies are generally considered the forerunner of doo-wop and rock and roll vocals. Ira Tucker's performance style and microphone technique have been credited with inspiring people like James Brown and Jackie Wilson in their stage shows. Nevertheless, the Hummingbirds have themselves never tried to perform secular music, but they were introduced to pop audiences when they accompanied Paul Simon on his Grammy-winning record, Loves Me Like a Rock. The Dixie Hummingbirds must hold a record for longevity. The group has performed for 56 years, with very few personnel changes. Tucker joined the group in 1938. Its founder, James Davis, is about to retire at the age of 69. A little later on in today's program, we'll meet Joe Williams, who was chosen to be the Birds' fourth voice when Davis leaves. Williams is the first new member of the group in 30 years. The Dixie Hummingbirds all live in Philadelphia, but they spend most of each year performing around the world. Ira Tucker grew up in South Carolina and moved to Philadelphia when he was 18. Ira Tucker, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Taryn. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thank you. Can you tell us how you first joined the Dixie Hummingbirds?
Well, yes. excuse me. I was working, and the group came to town. They are for about 32 miles from where I lived. So they came and got, I had a bass singer, and they came once. They needed a bass, and well, we wasn't doing nothing but just local things, so my bass left with the Hummingbirds. And he said, well, Tuck, later on I'll come back and I'll try to get you in the group, you know. So I said, yeah, okay. So I just completely stopped singing then, you know. And I guess about a couple months, maybe 3 months, they came back to sing. And I went to hear them that night, and I've been with them ever since.
How well known were they then? This was, what, 1938?
Yeah, the latter part of 38. Mm-hmm.
How well known were they? Did they already have a reputation nationally?
Well, yes. Davis had, they had been toured New York and different parts of the country, the states, like they did mostly North Carolina, and you know, but they had been in New York once and recorded in New York under the Decca label, and they had you know got back, and he made some changes in the group, you know, and that's how I got in. I got in totally unaware of the idea that I might not make it, because I was singing baritone. That was my thing, the baritone. And they needed a tenor singer. So I said, well, I'll try it, and if I know the way back home if I can't get it together. So I did it, you know, and later on, Davis was doing all the lead then, and later on I tried to lead a little bit, you know, and it worked out.
How did you work out the harmonies? When you listen to them now, they really sound like the music that you all inspired, doo-wop and rock and roll. Mm-hmm. How did you work out the harmonies that you've used?
Well, Terry, you see, now Davis, they had a style of singing that I used to hear them on Sunday mornings. I really liked their harmony, you know. He was doing all of the lead then. Well, there's another little fella, Wilson Baker, they call him High Pocket. He was also a lead singer. So they had an odd style, you know. And I liked it, so I just started trying to, I had heard them a good while, and I was just trying to keep the trend of what they were doing. Davis, he created that style, you know. He created the Hummingbird sound. And it was tremendous. I mean, you know, he had a beautiful sound back then. So as we would go, you know, I was just, and whatever little ideas that would come to me, I tried to still keep the same, you know, kind of relative to what he had already started, you know. And that's how I kept doing it until it became a part of me. You know, I just, everything I was trying to do it and get back to that hummingbird sound, you know.
When you were performing on the road has really been the downfall of many musicians. Many musicians who didn't have any problems before touring, once they're on the road, start drinking too much or taking drugs. And it's just really notorious for ruining the lives of musicians. What was it like for you as a quartet who was a religious quartet? You wanted to stay away from drugs and alcohol, but you were prone to the same kind of pressures that any other band on the road would be prone to.
Well, Terry, you see, number one, James Davis was raised up in the Holiness Church, and you couldn't smoke or drink or nothing like that, you know. And what happened is I used to hear him say, tell this, his first group, they went out to sing, and somebody had told his mother that one of the guys, after the program, was drinking, and that messed up that group for him, you know, because he was young then. So I said it to say this, see, when he got out, when he wanted to hit the road, you know, and wanted to make sure that he had the right kind of guys, he had to keep switching guys and check, you know. So, but it was just so happened that I was raised up not to do any of those things before I met them, you know. I wasn't doing any of that, you know. So it just worked out like that, and we had rules and regulations, what we still have, you know, after a certain length of time, you get accustomed to the way your lifestyle, you know, and the way that you know that you got to do, and it's easy, you know. You just, you know, you look at other people, you say, well, you know, I don't. I mean, it's guys out there that were kids, you know, that when we've got out there, you know, and I've noticed them that have grown up and got into rock and roll and drugs and everything else, you know, and, you know, back in some convalescent home or whatever, you know, finished at an early age, you know.
Well, sure, you know, a lot of popular performers, including people like Aretha Franklin, got started in the church.
Yes.
But then went on to be stars of pop music, of rhythm and blues, or soul music. Did you ever envy the people who you knew who had started singing gospel music and then had become great celebrities in the secular world?
No, I didn't, Terry, because I had some of the best offers I imagine during that time I could have had. The Golden Gate Quartet, you know, was a great Jubilee group. Bill Johnson did most of the writing of all of the traditional gospel. I had an offer to get with them, and it was back, I think it was 1942 or 3, and they sent me 4 telegrams in one day. So I don't know, Terry, I went over. I just wanted to see what was happening. So I went over to New York, and they were at the Roxy Theater with Groucho Marx and Helen Humes and different people. So they were doing this gospel thing, you know. So I jumped right in there with about a 15-minute, maybe 20-minute rehearsal. And I did 2 selections with them, you know. So he said, look, you might as well stay, and here's 3 weeks' pay, you know. The money was really, it really looked good. But I don't know, Terry, I just got to thinking about the time that I was trying to get in with the Hummingbirds, and we had got a little group going, you know, a little harmony, and you know, going, and I said, "Nah, I can't walk out on them, you know, because we were all up here then, and I was doing all of the lead then, so it was like they were depending on me." So I said to the manager of the Gates, I said, "I can't do it." I said, "Just give me some expense money for what I had to spend coming over, you know." So they took care of me. They gave me $50 for my expense. And back in that time, that $50 was a nice piece of money, you know, for me, you know. So I just, you know, I said, well, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't walk out on them. And
you might have tried to convince the group to start singing pop music, figuring that
yeah, but I, you know,
maybe,
see,
maybe you'd make a I big success that way.
I didn't like the secular music for myself, you know.
Why not?
I don't know. I just wanted to sing gospel. And I remember once my recording, the owner of the recording company, oh, he really cursed me out. And I said, well, you got a nerve. I said, now, here we are doing gospel for you. He said, but you're not, you know. Well, that was because he wanted a star in the other field, you know. But it's quite a few of them that I knew that did this, you know. It's a funny thing, but most of them are all dead.
You mean from drug problems or health problems or age?
Well, different, you know, different things. I don't know, Terry. I can't. It's hard to, well, just say it's coincidental. I don't know. I know that I can. I know of three fellows right now, just right off the bat, that was doing. I was doing gospel. Well, they came in since I was in there, you know. I say four, and they all gone.
Why don't we listen to another of the songs that you wrote, performed by you and the Dixie Hummingbirds?
Okay.
And we're going
to
hear...
I didn't mean to depress you.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, I just wanted to
all right.
Play another record. No, it has nothing to do with being depressed by what you're saying.
Okay, good.
No. My guest is Ira Tucker, who's the lead singer with the Dixie Hummingbirds, a group that's been together for 56 years. They perform gospel music around the world and are internationally known and loved. And let's listen to another gospel song written by Ira Tucker. And this is called The Good Won't Suffer. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Yes, Terry. I got the idea from John Henry. You know this song by John Henry? I was going along. I heard that somebody did an instrumental of that song. And so, you know, while I was just driving along and on the second round, I just started picking up lyrics, you know, on this Good Won't Suffer. That's how that came about, you know.
Great, okay. Why don't we listen to it? And this is Ira Tucker with the Dixie Hummingbirds.
I have a message for the sinners. You should not wait. I want you to go to Jesus before it too late. Now you can run around, my brother, and do all kinds of things and laugh about the good times you've had. Well, but there'll come a day when I see it coming, when the good won't suffer, when the bad. No, 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 when the good. seem to be going mad. Oh, but there'll come a day when I see it coming. When the good wants up on the bad. No. When the good wants up with the bad.
The Good Won't Suffer, featuring the Dixie Hummingbirds. That song was written by my guest, Ira Tucker, who's the lead singer with the Hummingbirds. Did your friends ever try to convince you to go into secular music and cash in on the success?
Oh, yes. Sure, Terry.
You told them to forget it?
Yes, I just doubt if I could feel comfortable doing it. I just couldn't. I needed the money, but I don't think I could, you know, just couldn't do it.
You grew up in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Was in the church that you went to, was music a really important part of the services?
No.
Really?
Way.
I'm really surprised to hear that. I just assumed that there was this great choir in whatever church you grew up with.
Not really, Terry. It was a choir there, but it's not an a cappella, you know. And they finally worked up to one piano, you know. But it was just a piano and voices, you know. That was it. Because when I came up, you see, they didn't do guitars in churches then, and drums and all that. It was one church out there. That was the House of Prayer, a place called the House of Prayer. They had horns and drums and all that, but not in the Baptist churches during that time, you know. Or the Methodists, you know. But we didn't have... Just had a choir, just almost a cappella, you know. But some of those women could really sing, though, you know.
Where did you develop that love of gospel music that you have, if it wasn't in the church?
Well, my mother sang. She had a beautiful voice. And my grandfather, my father couldn't do much singing, but my grandfather, he was known as one of the greatest bass singers around, you know, back in the woods back there where we came from. But after I got with the Hummingbirds, you know, see, I had a little group before then, and I was trying to find a lead singer, you know, because I had never tried to sing lead, you know. I loved the baritone part, you know. But after I started doing the lead, I learned a lot from James Davis. I really learned a lot from him.
Who was the most religious member in your family?
In my family?
Uh-huh.
My mother. She's, God rest her soul, she's gone now, but she was.
Did she keep you in the church or keep you religious at times when you might otherwise have strayed?
Yes. She was left-handed, and she she wouldn't tell me nothing but once. She'd tell me, you know, and the next thing she was on me, you know. But, you know, that was a different thing then, Terry. It's the whole concept is different now.
The concept of religion?
Well, that and disciplinary, whatever, you know, it's different now. See, because when I came along, if one of the neighbors would see you doing something, then they would give you a spanking and tell your parents, and then you get another one. But now you try that today, you get shot. Hitting somebody else's kid, you know. But I guess in time it'll all be back like it was.
How connected, this might sound like a stupid question to you, but how connected to is the singing of gospel music with religion? I mean, every time you sing, do you consider it an expression of your religious feelings? Or is it just the music that you love, and is it not necessarily always tied with mm-hmm. spirituality? With religion.
Well, Terry, excuse me. Some songs carry more of a feeling than others, and then some songs I love to do because of the sound that I'm able to project. In other words, that I'm if I can write something that's kind of pretty, you know. I like to sing things with. Different chords or different phrasing, whatever, you know, vibrato, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are times when you feel downhearted, you know, and like in a low ebb, you know, and you write songs according to the way you feel, you know, with a feeling, you know. And I guess it's just like it's everyday living. Because someday you feel different, you know. Right?
Mm-hmm. So it's everyday living expressed in
yes.
the gospel style.
Right, right.
You moved to Philadelphia from South Carolina when you were about 18. Why'd you move north? Do you remember?
Well, I was with the Birds
at the time.
And, yeah,
mm-hmm.
and they had been up here. Then I have relatives, you know. Then that were up here then, and Davis said, "Well, let's you want to try to go back and see what can we do." You know, we had been all in West Virginia and all, you know, and. A guy told us there. See, during that time, Terry, we had a very close harmony group. We weren't doing the outstretched tunes, you know, just doing a lot of jubilee and close harmony. So the guys told us in Beckley, West Virginia, said you need to go maybe to New York or Philadelphia or somewhere, you know. So when we came here, we got on WCAU for maybe a year and 6 months. You know, I was doing on that WCAU every day. And the days that we didn't make it, they had a tape they played for us.
Is that one of the reasons why you decided to stay?
Yeah, we decided to stay then because we went from there to Cafe Society in New York. We sang there 6 months.
Yeah, well, that's a very famous club in New York
yes.
that mostly featured small jazz groups and,
right.
and jazz singers.
Yes.
You were, I believe, the first gospel group to play in settings like that. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, the Golden Gates did more of that than we did. But they were called a Jubilee group. We were, and you were right about the gospel, you know. We were about the first gospel group to do that. But we found that in some instances the audience was even better than some church audiences. I mean, while you are into it, the people are really into it. You know, a lot of people have said, "But we worked in a club that the guy said, well, I don't believe in the hereafter, but I like what you're doing." You know, and he would get into it. But when it was over with him. But the idea of the whole thing was then a matter of survival, you know, which is the same as today, you know. But we really got in some good shots around, but we changed our name to the Jericho Quintet for the clubs.
Why'd you do that?
Well, we just figured that during that time, the gospel audiences, the gospel people wasn't ready for a nightclub group. So we worked under the Jericho Quintet and Cafe Society, but back in the church, we was the Dixie Hummingbirds. And then on WCAU, we were known as the Swanee a quartet.
And this was also that the gospel audiences wouldn't feel offended by the
right
other contexts that you were singing in.
Right. I met a lot of people, you know, big people, Billie Holiday, Lena Horne. Lena used to come in and clap for us, you know, in the front seat. Well, it was nice. We did a wonderful thing there. But our bass singer went to the service, and that's why we had to give it up, because it's hard to get a man there, you know, that was during that wartime, you know, and couldn't hardly find a guy that could excel like he did. So we just went on back to the churches, you know, back after we did pick up a bass singer, but the guy figured that he didn't have time for us to rehearse and try to get him into an act. He just pulled the Golden Gates down there because they were already uptown at the Uptown Cafe.
Have you gotten really different receptions, especially in like the 30s and the 40s, in the South than you did in the North? Was it a different environment playing in the South and the North, especially when the South was segregated?
Oh, yes. We had to pay $50 one night because the cops said our lights was too bright. You name it, and we've been through it. We came through a town in Mississippi doing 20 miles an hour, and there was a guy there that said we was doing 60. And we got a ticket, a $50 ticket. So he said, I didn't see you speeding, said, but it was a white man that turned you in. So we said, yeah, we understand. We were born and raised down here, you know, in South Carolina, which was just as bad. But, you know, I thought about the scriptures, you know, and I said, well, you have to live with something, you know. I had a good. I do a lot of reading, Bible, and the hardships that Jesus went through while on earth to let us know what we had to go through, you know. So he was, they turned him down to the extent where they had to go to a stable for Mary to, I mean, his daddy, you know, and mother and father. To for Jesus to be born, you know, but you have to. It's something, Terry, that you have to put in your mind and think of that one thing, because otherwise you would crack up, or you would do something wrong. You understand where I'm coming from?
Mm-hmm.
You see.
I mean, you'd be so angry that if you didn't...
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't put it into
a
transcendent
it.
Context.
Right,
that you
right.
Would have blown up, probably.
Right. We've gone places and it said, you know, white only. And if we wanted anything to eat, we had to go around to the back. It was like a pigeonhole, not even a window, you know. But... You know, you have to, when you say no cross, no crown, I mean, that's what you're talking about, you know.
Were you ever harassed in black churches when you'd be singing there? Were the churches harassed, or was it pretty safe there?
Well, every now and then, there is some crackpot, you know, would maybe want to come in for nothing or something like that. But usually it's, you know, you're around black churches, it's, they come in and, you know, because everybody was on the same gun, you know, I mean. And the only thing you could do is just go there and have a program, you know, and get out. But it's been really a trip, the whole concept, you know. It's really been a trip. But I'm just thankful to God that we had a leader that we followed up until, well, he's still with us. He haven't completely retired yet, but we had wonderful leader.
Is the responsibility going to fall on you now to be the leader of the group when James Davis retires?
Not really. I think we're going to be more like a gentleman's agreement, you know. And I think because, see, I'm not able to project what he did, you know. Because it makes a difference when you create something, or when you get something together yourself. Understand what I mean? So I came in a group that was ready made, and well, as of now, I'm the next member. You know,
in seniority.
Yes, I mean. For, yeah, groups in your seniority. But I think we'll do it like we just feel, I want to feel like Davis is still with us when he leave. And I want to project the same things that he had and taught us from that time up to now. And that's all we need, because see, it's just a daily routine of the same thing.
Do you know what those things are that you want to maintain?
Right.
Do you know exactly what they are? Could you?
Yes, discipline and being on time, punctuality, rather, and watching our fines, keeping up the fines. If you don't have the same tie or the same socks, we have to have this in a uniform. It consists of the same thing. And if we pay $5 for the tie if it's different, or the handkerchief if we're wearing one, the socks, whatever, you know. So the rules and the regulations and the punctuality, you know, and the disciplinary aspects of the whole thing. We want to keep all of that going. I just feel like his spirit is with us, you know, whenever he leave, because we'll be in constant contact with him anyway, you know. But we won't ever really be without a manager. That's the way I feel.
Do you look back and say to yourself, gosh, it's remarkable that the group has stayed together for 56 years?
Yes.
Not many groups of
that's
any
right.
variety they can say
and
that.
And I give him all of that credit for keeping the group, because there were times when I got a little woolly myself, you know, and he would say, okay, you know, this is the way it is, you know, even if it's him. See, that's... See, he didn't do nothing for us that he didn't tell us nothing to do that he wouldn't do himself, you know. And when you're supposed to meet at a certain place, he's there first. So you see, what can you say about a man like that for these many years, you know?
Although the group stayed together, do you think that gospel music has remained as popular as it was? Do you think that the tradition is being carried on?
Well, Terry, I'll tell you what, dear. I think that the gospel itself is beautiful, but I'm not the type of person, I don't like to criticize, you know, because there are people that love all kinds of music. What I would call secular, somebody else would call a hot gospel, you know. But I say, as an overall a figure, so to speak, you're figuring on the people that used to play the traditional gospel, it ain't too much of that being played now. You see, and it seemed like it's getting away from the owners. I mean, we can't, you know, at one time, be proud to know that traditional gospel is moving, you know, in every state, and it would still move now. But you see, the difference is it's a lot of younger people in the world now that didn't know anything about the traditional, and a lot of them that don't want to know anything about it, you know. A lot of the young people seem to feel that the traditional spirituals is a yoke. But that's a joke. It's not, because we have the same God that we had back then, you know. So it's nothing has really changed. It's just the people are started changing. You know what I mean? So, but every now and then we do run into even a young commentator, DJ, so to speak, that love the traditional gospel singing, and they got a good audience, because that's how it started.
I know that probably a lot of our listeners were first introduced to your music through the recording that you made with Paul Simon of mm-hmm. his song Loves Me Like a Rock.
Right.
Now, that's a song he wrote, though it's a song that's very associated with your group. Mm-hmm. How would you rate it as a gospel song? Do you think it's a good song?
Yes, but you see now, Terry, according to the lyrics, we had that in question, you know, at first, but it says, when I was a little boy, the devil would call my name, and I'd say, "Who do you think you're fooling? I'm a consecrated boy." Well, this is in keeping with the gospel
tradition.
Yes, tradition. And then it tells about when he's grown to be a man. In other words, it is a gospel. But you see, you can take Amazing Grace and put some, like, enough horns and strings and synthesizers, and look what they did to When the Saints Go Marching In. You know, this is it's like a finale in a lot of places, you know what I mean? So the words are good, When the Saints Go Marching In, but I mean, look, those saints be swinging, you know, from the way.
Do you like your recording?
Hmm?
Do you like your recording of Loves Me Like a Rock?
Yes, mm-hmm. I told Paul that I had to do mine. He said, "Hey, I wish I could have done the way you did it." He said, "You got the Grammy and I didn't."
All right. Listen, time has just flown, and I really regret that we're out of time. It's really been a great pleasure to meet you.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And I've enjoyed your music for years, and it's
I'm glad
to have the opportunity to meet you. So let me remind our listeners, I've been speaking with Ira Tucker, who's the lead singer and also one of the main songwriters for the Dixie Hummingbirds, which is a world-famous gospel group that is based here in Philadelphia, though they are touring much of the year.